there, and welcome to the Post Ryder Cup 2023 episode of Musings on Golf, where you will hear terrific insights from Jeff Rood, one of golf's great writers and storytellers. My name is Kelly Elbin, along with my good buddy Bob Bupka. And Bob, before we bring on our good friend, Mr. Rood, for our roundtable discussion, I have long felt and said that the U.S. players want to win the Ryder Cup. I've never doubted it. I also have known, and you guys would I believe, back me up, that the Europeans live for the Ryder Cup. And I think we saw that in the way the stars, the top guys, played in Rome. It was very evident, literally from the start, that they were ready to go. And a dominant performance, really, by the Europeans once it was done on Sunday. Bob, how about your initial impressions on yet another home victory for the Europeans?
Well, the one explanation I got early on was that, you know, Europe has the Ryder Cup in their heart. The U.S. team has the Ryder Cup in their mind. And what we saw was an incredible performance by the European team. The Ryder Cup, and Jeff will be able to speak on this even a lot better than I. It's a thrill to have Jeff Rood join us. I worked many years beside him, and I saw the one thing that separates Jeff. He has the respect probably of more players than anybody that's ever covered the game, and that gives him a huge advantage. But it's just amazing how much the European team wants to win the Ryder Cup. And I just think there's too much on the U.S. side. They want to play on the Ryder Cup team, and they want to get paid to play on the Ryder Cup team. I don't know, but we'll get into all of that. Let me just say hello to Jeff Rood. And, hey, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us. I know everything you have to say. We had quite a talk the other day. Is certainly intriguing, and I think our listeners are going to enjoy it very much.
Well, Bob, thank you, and Kelly, thank you, too, for the kind words. I'm flattered, if not moist-eyed right now. Thank you.
You know what I think, Kelly, before we even start with Jeff Rood, because at the end, after we talk Ryder Cup, we're going to want Jeff to share a little bit about his bucket list trip that he went on. But I still contend, and I think Jeff will back me up. And Kelly, if you have an argument that differs, I think Jeff, I had the pleasure of playing with Jeff here. Four courses back to back: Brookline, Maidstone, National, Shinnecock. That was four courses back to back. And the funny part of the story is you needed a member to play with when we played Maidstone. So a friend of mine fixed me up with this guy named Joe Kasikas, and we're on the first tee, and Jeff said, "Brian and I will play you and Joe." I said, "Yeah, that sounds like fun." So what does Joe Kasikas do? I think he's like four under par through the first six holes. And Jeff turns and looks at me, and he said, "Who the hell is Joe Kasikas?"
I mean, well, can I counter that story? I did on the 11th tee. I did turn to him and said, "Who the hell is Joe Kasikas?" But Hewitt and I didn't offer to be partners against Bubby and Joe Kasikas. Joe Kasikas, by the way, was 6'6". He weighed about 135 pounds wet. And he made six birdies in the first 10 holes. Bubby got this guy lined up. It's the greatest parking lot job that's ever been put on me in golf gambling.
I claim the fifth. But how about those four golf courses?
Talk about bucket lists. Yes.
And we're gonna get to your remarkable trip overseas here a little bit later. Hey, Jeff. Okay, so you covered 12 Ryder Cups. You told me more than 100 major championships, including 82 in a row. I know that's a source of great pride for you. You've seen, therefore, a lot of the heat of the moment competitions in the Ryder Cup. Give us, as same with Bob, how about some initial thoughts from what you saw from afar over the 3 days in Rome?
Well, a lot went right for Europe. You know, I think I you know, the Genius Network says that any team member or employee needs to have three things: AMC, attitude, motivation, and commitment. And that European team certainly has it. Whether the U.S. team has it as high as theirs, it doesn't necessarily seem to be. But a lot went right for Europe. You know, the motivational videos that had everybody crying on Monday. I mean, how good is that? Seve's shirt in the middle of the locker room. I mean, getting jacked up. And they putted and chipped great for a day and a half. I mean, Rahm's chipping in, and they're making putts left and right. And their big three excelled. Okay, Rahm, McIlroy, and Victor played, and the U.S. big boys didn't play. So, I mean, from a European side, what went right for them, that's what I saw.
How about from the U.S. side, what went wrong, in your opinion?
You know, this podcast could last about 3 hours, and I might not get through the whole thing, to be honest
with
you.
Absolutely.
I don't. The first thing that went wrong is LIV happened, okay? So what we had here, we didn't necessarily have a Ryder Cup, guys. We had a PGA Tour Cup. I mean, Brooks Koepka was the only LIV person probably in all of Italy, all right? And, you know, I told his agent, I said, you know, Brooks is, as an LIV lone wolf, he is like the only Russian at a 4th of July parade in Arlington, Virginia. I mean, he was just the, you know, so LIV happened. And so Dustin Johnson not only wasn't picked, he wasn't even called. Bryson DeChambeau, who shot 58, wasn't even not picked, but he wasn't called. Okay, so that's the first thing that happened, is a fracture of potential U.S. 12 players. And then Zach made some picks that, you know, have been criticized. I mean, you could make a very good argument that Lucas Glover, given the fact that the rough was high and the fairways were narrow, and that he reinvented himself with a putter, that Lucas and Bradley and DJ and Bryson DeChambeau, those four guys needed a hard look, I think. And I said that beforehand. The buddy system obviously was in place, okay? You know, as it turns out, Zach's picks, which were, you know, some people thought were questionable, went 4-12-4 in 20 matches. I'll repeat that, 4-12-4. Okay, 9 of the 12 had 5 weeks off before the Ryder Cup. Now, you tell me, is there any top player in the world ever to take 5 weeks off before a major championship? The answer is obviously no. So if you want to look at, if you want to get an idea of want to and desire, you just look at action. Because they speak. I thought Zach, you know, Zach had a rough week. He's a nice guy, like Zach, but he had a rough week. I mean, sending out Sam Burns an alternate shot, lead off the first round. You know, Sam was last on the team as far as tee to green accuracy. It wasn't right. And then he led off the alternate shot the next day with Jordan Spieth, who sprayed it all over the lot on the first day, on Friday. That was probably the highest point of malpractice, I thought. You know, sitting a five-time major champion in the first session, Koepka doesn't play the first session. I don't know. Do you think Europe would ever sit down a five-time major champion in the first session of the Ryder Cup? I don't think so. Maybe the most amazing thing that I've ever seen in any Ryder Cup happened the second day. The big bully team of Scheffler and Koepka, five-time major champion, number one in the world, lost 9-7 to a guy who never played a major championship before. Oh, my Lord, have mercy. And two last things. Azinger said in the first hour of the telecast on Sunday that Davis Love told him that morning that the U.S. team came in flat. Now I ask you, how is it possible to come in flat to play in a Ryder Cup? I mean, you know, and again, this is the first world number one who didn't win a point, Scheffler, in decades. And one last thing. I watched their news conference after they lost. They seemed a little too happy too soon.
And it's great stuff. Bob, I agree with that assessment from Davis Love that they look flat. To echo what Jeff said, Bob Bupka, how in the world do you come in flat for a Ryder Cup, whether you're an American or European? If it's that big of an event, you have to be totally ready, don't you?
Well, I would agree with Jeff and everything that he said. You know, the amazing thing is the captain's picks. of Zach Johnson. It's like the old buddy system, Fred Couples and Davis Love. And you know, that's the responsibility of the assistant captains, to make Zach Johnson's team members fired up and you know, chomping at the bit to get to that first tee. And I didn't see any of that on the American side. As Jeff accurately pointed out, they were almost too casual. I mean, you know, it's a chance of a lifetime. It's a chance to put your name in the golf history books with a magnificent performance in a Ryder Cup. So I can't buy being too flat. I mean, that's just not acceptable in my book. I wouldn't have anybody on my team that could even be suspect of being too flat.
You know, hey Jeff, in addition to a lot of golf you've covered through the years, you're also worked for the Chicago Sun-Times, Dallas Morning News. I know you've covered a lot of football games. And when an NFL team is coming into a place like Philadelphia, or they're going a hornet's nest like that, I mean, it seems to me it's part of the responsibility of the coach and the staff to prepare those players for something that they may not be expecting. They might not be the norm. And if you go in to play the Eagles, who are really good, and you're not prepared, you will get blown out. But if you go in and you have some sort of sense of what you're getting into, and the practices are different going into, maybe you have a shot at beating them. I was stunned, as Bob said. Look, sorry to be repetitious, Zach's a good man. He wasn't ready. He wasn't ready. And play as the captain, somehow, can't you get your guys to play other than two guys who played out in that Fortinet championship event on the West Coast of the United States? Can't you get them to play more than 5 weeks into or before the Ryder Cup? How is that possible?
No, I agree. You know, I will give the U.S. team this. Once they got going, you know, what were they down? 9.5, 2.5 after the first day? Once they got going, they played well, but they showed up too late. You know,
but it's only a 3-day event. You can't show up late for 3 days.
No, I understand. No, it's a trophy. It's a mad dash. I get it. It's a trophy dash. And I mean, this is Don Garlitz. This is a drag race here. This is not 500 miles around the oval. But they made it closer than I thought they would once they were down so far. I mean, so I'll give them that. But and they made Europe sweat on Sunday, which I was surprised. Hats off to pun intended. Hats off to Cantlay for the hat trick at the end of Saturday's golf.
What'd you make of that with Cantlay with not wearing the hat, Jeff?
I'm going to take him at face value over it, that he says it doesn't fit. You know, I just talked to my friend John McGinnis, who's still in Rome, and I asked him whether he thought that was a protest or not, and he goes, no. He walked with him at Whistling Straits. He didn't wear a cap there either. Now, the curious thing about it is, if Patrick wanted, and I guess Polo USA made those caps, I'm guessing.
Right.
It may have been New Era with the caps, but Polo is certainly the uniform. Yeah.
Right. So whoever the manufacturer is on the caps, if a player on the team says, hey, the cap doesn't fit me right, can you make one that fits the way I like it? I'm thinking it might happen.
Hey, Bob, can we talk a little bit about the foursomes? Great strategic decision by Luke Donald to go with the alternate shot at the start, and the Europeans won all four. Mm-hmm. Is there anything, start with Bob, is there anything that you think the U.S. can do to have a better understanding and ability to at least try to hold its own, and if nothing else, get 2 points from an alternate shot format and not get blown out?
Yeah, probably the only thing that can be done is encourage players. Once the team is decided, I mean, if I'm captain, I'm going to say, hey, guys, why don't you get one of your friends or, you know, a fellow teammate and just schedule a couple of rounds and play alternate shot, just so that you feel a little more comfortable with it. And it's not a stranger when you get on the team. One thing I want to bring up, and I want to get Jeff's opinion on this. I am of the feeling that the captain of the U.S. side has a lot of restrictions placed on him. It's not all just Zach Johnson making all these calls. I think a lot of the captain's picks were by committee, and Zach may or may not have gotten, you know, outvoted. But to leave Lucas Glover, former U.S. Open champion, won back-to-back on the PGA Tour this year, not on the team. Keegan Bradley, who, you know, exudes red, white, and blue probably more so than anybody, he's left off the team. So we were undergunned before we got to Rome, and then the slaughter was on.
Yeah, you know, I think you've got 12 guys going in an airplane to Europe to end a 30-year drought. They haven't won since 93. I happened to be there in 93 to watch that. But you're going on that plane without Dustin Johnson, okay? I mean, that's malpractice, okay? Again, he wasn't only just not picked. He wasn't called, all right? So, I mean, he went 5-0 in the last round. Dustin Johnson, okay? You think that Ludwig Aubert would might look at Dustin Johnson on the first tee and go, oh my. So, you know, that's just one. And DeChambeau shot 58 shortly before the picks. I mean, if Justin Thomas had shot 58 right before the picks, Zach Johnson would have thrown a ticker tape parade for him. BDC didn't get a call. So I'm with you on the Glover thing, particularly since he's a wonderful ball striker. He would have fit those narrow fairways and high rough. And he was a different guy with the putting stroke. He made a big change that worked. So, and I'm with you on Bradley, too. It's easy to second guess after.
Take a real quick break here from our good friends at Titleist, and plenty more to talk about when we return.
Titleist is the number one ball in golf. Yes, being number one is a number. And more players trust the Pro V1 or Pro V1X than all other golf balls combined. But being number one is more than a number. It's a mindset. It's a relentless mission to design and manufacture the best performing golf balls in the game, so you can chase whatever your number one is. Titleist, the number one ball in golf.
Welcome back to Musings on Golf. Kelly Elvin along with Bob Bupka, joined by our special guest, Jeff Ruud. Hey, so Jeff, the Xander Schauffele flap came out right after the Ryder Cup with his dad and some contractual issues and Xander almost being thrown off the team, et cetera. You're, in addition to being a great writer, you're a great reporter, and you've reached out to some agents. What have you found out?
Yeah, well, I talked to a former Ryder Cup player last night for about an hour, and I talked to an agent who's had a lot of players who have played in the Ryder Cup, including at least two in this one. I sent him the Schauffele story about, the PGA of America was close to booting him off the team because he didn't sign a contract. And the agent said Netflix in the team room is outrageous, which I said earlier I agree with. He said contractual arguments and threats are a great way to prepare for a Ryder Cup. No wonder we lost. And I mean, he makes a decent point there. If there's any kind, again, I remember what I said. The first thing I said on the show was attitude, motivation, and commitment are most important in any endeavor.
Yeah, I agree. Hey, Bob. So it goes back to, I think, from a financial standpoint for the DP World Tour, and all 12 of the European players are members of that tour. It's their by far their biggest asset, the Ryder Cup, when it's played in Europe. For our guys, Americans, who are members of the PGA Tour, it's the PGA of America that reaps the financial windfall from the Ryder Cup, and particularly when it's played here in the United States. I'm not surprised to hear about this this desire to get paid at some point. How about your thoughts on the monetary aspect of the Ryder Cup?
Jeff and Kelly is reach out to a couple of people and just feeling them out. I wanted to get a better pulse of this compensation thing. And the one argument that was presented to me, and I'd like to run it up our flagpole right now and get Jeff's thoughts and yours, Kelly, is, you know, the PGA Tour made about $20 million last week. $20 million, the PGA Tour. Now, what's wrong with the PGA Tour cutting, let's say, a check for $500,000 to every one of their members that are participating, and then compensation is not an issue. Team unity is better. And I think it's only right that the PGA Tour, if they're deriving that kind of money, that they take care of their own players.
Well, you know, that's a good point. My understanding, I talked to somebody who was on the grounds last week. My understanding is that Shoffley didn't want to sign the contract because of the Netflix thing. He didn't want Netflix in the team room. And I understand that.
I wouldn't have either.
Right. And it was a unanimous thing once it was put to the team. But he also, you know, Netflix is doing a season two of those documentaries that they did. And Shoffley, early in the year, he declined being a part of that too. So he's consistent there. But when his dad said we need to revisit, you know, the financial part of it, that all of a sudden, you know, that raises alarm bells. Now, you know, I have said many times, I have written that Tim Fincham's second biggest stroke of brilliance as a PGA commissioner was in the 90s when there was this we need to get paid thing and players mm-hmm. were going in the hole. He created the WGC event in Firestone, which was just for Ryder Cup and President's Cup players. So they could play the Ryder Cup and the President's Cup cleanly, but they would get compensated by prize money, you know, in the back end, which I thought was brilliant. Now, what is Fincham's greatest stroke in Ponte Vedra? It was the creation of the President's Cup, which got, at the time, the FTC was breathing down the PGA Tour's neck over the 501C, and he rallied the politicos and got the President's Cup, and the FTC investigation went away. So a little off track there, but...
No, great background. Guys, can we look ahead to 2025 at what will be a very raucous crowd, to say the least, at Bethpage Black on Long Island, Bob Bupka's backyard, if you will. The U.S. last time it was on home turf, it was a dominating 19-9 victory at Whistling Straits. Now the U.S. is humbled. How does the United States go about reversing course once again and finding ways to at least somehow get a victory, which hasn't really been a problem in recent Ryder Cups on home soil? Bob, I really believe Tiger Woods is going to be the next captain of the Ryder Cup team for the U.S. Bob, thoughts on Tiger as the captain of 25 and what you expect at Bethpage?
Well, having grown up in the shadow of Bethpage and having played it many times, I think the challenge is going to be a little bit different. The U.S. team is going to have the challenge of Bethpage. It's reported to be the toughest golf course in America. So they can't just focus on Europe. They got to focus on their own ability to be able to play Bethpage and play it in fine fashion. And I can assure you that's not going to be an easy trick. The one main thing going well for the United States team when they get to Bethpage, anybody that thought the crowds at Marco Simone were rowdy, forget about it, is the saying on Long Island. I mean, I don't know. I mean, they're going to have to guard against it getting rowdy more so than trying to whip up some spirit for the U.S. team.
Jeff Root, thoughts as we look ahead?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think, you know, some of the answers we've already come up with. You can't take 5 weeks off going in there. You need to be more prepared. You can't come in flat. You know, Bob is right. This Ryder Cup could get out of hand. I mean, from a fan standpoint, I mean, of all the majors I've covered, by far, the rowdiest were the ones at Bethpage. I mean, I felt like I was those events, you know, when they were counting Sergio's waggles in Spanish, and they were very creative. But I felt like I was at it was a Yankee Stadium type crowd in the seventh inning after everybody's had a six pack of beer. I mean, it is not for the faint of heart, and it could get out of hand. I'm not saying it will, but it wouldn't surprise me if somebody crossed the line there. Yeah. And by the way, the U.S. team can't come out flat there with all that screaming going on.
Just follow up one thing with Jeff. I think probably PJ of America doesn't need me to tell him that, but I think whatever security they've had in the past, I think conservatively it should be doubled, if not mm-hmm. tripled, just to yes. make sure that it stays a golf competition.
Yes.
I want to get, I know Bob also wants to hear about your great trip overseas, but to kind of put a wrap on this as far as into 25, guys, does it make sense that Luke Donald has an encore performance as European Ryder Cup captain? And does Tiger Woods make the most sense, at least as we look at it right now, for it to be the U.S. captain in 25 at Bethpage?
Yeah, Donald makes sense. You know, Tiger makes sense too, as long as we're going to stick with the task force thing, which started because Phil didn't like the way Watson handled 2014. And then it has evolved into the buddy system. I mean, Zach himself said the six picks were guys that the six qualifiers had. And so.
I think Tiger Woods only takes it, Jeff, if he has more control somehow, which as the alpha male, I would almost, as a fan of United States, I want him. I want him. I don't want the players dictating who's going to be their partners. I want Tiger right. Woods making wise decisions yes. Yes. as the captain. Yes. And ultimately, it falls to the captain to make yes. the decisions, not to the troops.
I agree with you 100%. Let the coaches coach and the players play. You know, the captain gets to see a panoramic view. The players are only looking at fractured things. You know, I sometimes wonder whether, an authoritarian coach would be better with that, because the players, it just seems too, I don't know. I mean, other candidates I would have if we went outside of golf would be Steve Kerr, Mike Krzyzewski, the most dominant sportsman in the world right now, Joey Chestnut. I know you think I'm kidding. And Ted Lasso, if we're not going to do Tiger.
You've known Tiger a long time. What are your thoughts on Tiger as a potential captain? And do you have any guys beyond Ted Lasso who might be able to fit the bill?
Let me just say this much. The way Tiger, and I agree with you, Tiger is the ideal candidate to be captain. Whether he ultimately decides that he's willing to do that, that's another story. It's not automatic that Tiger is going to want to be the Ryder Cup captain. But the way his son Charlie's playing, if he keeps continuing to improve at this rate, Tiger will shock the whole world and say, I'm picking my son Charlie to be on my team.
Tiger, when he played in all those Ryder Cups, intimidated not only the opponent, but he intimidated his own teammates, I think, his own partners. And if he's the captain, I hope he motivates rather than intimidates.
Oh, I think he'll motivate. Right. I think he's, it's ironic, isn't it, that the guy who at the very start of the Ryder Cup talked about it almost being an exhibition. And I think from a legacy standpoint, it's always been important to him. I could absolutely see him being the captain of 25, the U.S. wins, and then they ask him again, and it would in 27, it would be his goal to try to end what would then be a 34-year winless streak for the Americans at Adel Manor in Ireland. I could absolutely see that as his vision.
But he's got to bring passion to this event, okay? I mean, he's been an individual. I want to go back to 2004, Kelly, at Oakland Hills in the pre-thing. Somebody asked Tiger, would you rather win the WGC that you just did or the Ryder Cup? And he goes, I got a million reasons why I'd rather win the WGC, which means he won $1 million. The same 48 hours, Sergio Garcia got up and said, we live for this thing.
That's right.
So I think, you know, Rory McIlroy used to think it was an exhibition, but now look at the passion he has for it. Tiger Woods as a captain with passion would be a beautiful thing.
No question. Speaking of beautiful things, you had an unbelievable bucket list trip to play some amazing golf courses. Jeff, you posted a lot of it on a day-to-day basis on Facebook. Give our listeners a sense of what you did, and particularly the stories about the Midnight Cemetery visit at St. Andrews, please.
Yeah, well, we played 11 rounds in 9 days. You know, we played Royal Dornick twice, Brora, Nairn, Castle Stewart, Cruden Bay, Carnoustie, King's Barnes, North Berwick twice, and Gullin number one, which was really, really good. I mean, my favorites of those were, if there's a more spectacular golf course in the world than King's Barnes, I haven't seen it. I mean, King's Barnes and Dornick and North Berwick are my favorites. North Berwick just exudes quirky cool. And then in St. Andrews, I've run several midnight tours to the cemetery down the, you know, in St. Andrews, that where old Tom Morris and young Tom Morris lie at rest, and Alan Robertson, the first club pro. And it started in 2000. I'm out on the 14th hole at the old course watching Seve Ballesteros play, and I looked in the gallery, and I saw Jim Nance in the gallery, and I did like a triple take. And I go, "What are you doing over there?" And he said, "Well, I was in London with my wife on holiday." And I said, "Hey, I've never been to a British Open. Can I have a hall pass?" And so here I am. Well, that night around midnight, Jim walked in front of the Dunvegan Hotel where Golf Week was staying. And I was out there. And I said, "Hey, Jim, old Tom and young Tom are buried in the cemetery down the street. Do you want to go?" And he goes, "Yes." So I went and get a flashlight. When I came out, there were like 15 people ready to march down the street with us. And so we went over and we put the flashlight on young Tommy's gravesite, which has a lot of words on it. And my buddy at Golf Week, Ken Carpenter, was reading it. And finally, Jeff Babineau said, "Hey, Kenny, we happen to have the golden voice of Jim Nance with us. Maybe he should be reading it." So Nance read the rest of it. 10 years later, I'm having breakfast at the Dunvegan at the 2010 Open, and my phone rings, and the voice at the other end with the Masters theme says, "How would you like to continue a tradition unlike any other tonight?" And I said, "Jim, does that mean you want to go over the wall tonight?" And he goes, "Yes." I go, "I'll meet you outside at 11:30. He goes, "Deal." That conversation literally lasted about 30 seconds. So we went over the wall that night. And we probably had 20, 25 people this time. And then in 15, I wasn't at the Open, but my son was there, and he went over with Nance. And after they did it, Nance called me and said, "It wasn't the same without you," which was really cool. This time I took my boys over. You know, I went with three other guys. Two of them had never been to Scotland. I took them over on another midnight tour. And it was kind of spooky because when we went, first of all, it's harder to climb over the wall than it used to be, okay? Maybe it has something to do with age. But when we got over the wall, all these birds came out of the trees, and they were, you know, it was almost like they were ghosts. And then one last thing about it, Jim Nance told Eli Manning about it, and you guys can Google Eli Manning Cemetery, St. Andrews. And he did a podcast with Eli and somebody else. So when Eli was over there, I guess for the last Open, he went over the wall too. I don't know what time of day he went, but yeah. So that's a tradition unlike any other.
Well, and an unbelievably cool tradition. It's part of the fabric of such a unique and special place as St. Andrews, isn't it?
Yeah. And I texted Nance, by the way, after we when I got climbed back over after we did it, and I said, "We missed you. I just went over the wall," and sent him a photo, and he goes, "That's fantastic. Sorry, I missed it." He goes, "Can you still climb over the wall?" I go, "Yeah, it's harder though."
Hey guys, before we wrap it up, saw today that that Lexi Thompson is going to become the seventh woman to play a PGA Tour event. Received a special invite to play in the Shriners Children's event next week in Las Vegas. I believe Babe Zaharias was the very first woman to ever play in a PGA Tour event. Pretty cool company for Lexi to be the seventh member of that group.
Yeah, good for her. I hope she plays well because she's been a little off in the last year or so, right?
She's one of the nicest people you're ever going to want to meet, and I echo your sentiments, Jeff. I hope she plays well. A real sweetheart, a real great ambassador for the sport of golf.
Hey, Bob, it's just been terrific having Jeff Rude with us. Bob, I wonder if you could maybe just to close it out, were there, in your opinion, are there lessons learned from an American perspective? Are there lessons learned from 3 days in Rome that perhaps can help them as they look ahead to trying to reclaim the cup in 2 years on Long Island?
Well, I think Jeff touched on most of the key points. They have to be better prepared. You can't take 5 weeks off like Jeff told us. No, nobody's going to enter the Masters that's eligible to play and not play 5 weeks before the event. I mean, it's ludicrous. Better prepared. You know, the home team gets the choice of the golf course. One wild suggestion that I heard that would change the Ryder Cup completely is that the away team gets to pick the golf course. So the Europeans would pick what course in the States they want to play, and vice versa. The United States team would get to pick what course in Europe. I mean, that is way out there, but it would probably be very interesting.
That's not going to happen. What you're going to see at Bethpage Black is you're going to see wider fairways and low rough as a setup, because you know the home team needs to set it up to their advantage.
Good point, Jeff. And Bethpage, no matter how it's set up, is going to be a wonderful examination of the best players in the world participating in the best team competition in golf.
No question about it. Jeff Rood, it's been an absolute pleasure having you join us. Thank you so much for your time and your insights, Bob. We'll gather just the two of us together next week with a special guest. For Jeff Rood and for Bob Bupka, Kelly Elbin signing off, Musings on Golf.